Thank you. So good evening and greetings from Poland, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to present our latest results in causal dynamical triangulations. So I will be happy to answer any questions during my talk, so please ask them, and maybe you can even interrupt me by voice because I might not see your hand. So my talk will be split into three parts. I will begin with a short introduction to an approach to quantum gravity called causal dynamical triangulations. Second, I will present how to introduce a good coordinate system using classical scalar fields. And in the third part, I will discuss the impact of dynamical scalar fields on quantum geometries and explain observed phenomena using mini superspace models. So let me first start with what is causal dynamical triangulations? It is a background-independent and diffeomorphism-invariant approach to quantum gravity. So it provides a lattice regularization of the formal gravitational path integral. And so instead of integrating over continuous geometries, like you can see in the left picture, so in fact, this picture that represents a geometry should be below the integral sign, we approximate such integrals with the sum over triangulations, so like discretizations of those geometries. And we take a specific class of so-called causal triangulations. I will focus on that later. So this is just CDT in short. It just gives us a way how to approximate expectation values of some observables where we would like to integrate over geometries, but instead we sum over triangulations. So as I said, instead of calculating expectation values of some observables, which depend on geometries. So instead of integrating over geometries here, and by geometry, we understand it is an equivalence class of metrics on some manifold with respect to diffeomorphisms. We approximate this formal gravitational path integral by a sum over triangulations. And now the triangulations are weighted with the so-called Reger action. The Reger action is just the Einstein-Hilbert action calculated on our triangulation. So now our geometries are piecewise linear. They are just simplicial manifolds, simplicial complexes built of four-dimensional simplices. And so if you evaluate the Einstein-Hilbert action on a simplicial manifold, you end up with the so-called Reger action, which has a very simple form. It is a linear combination of some global parameters like number of vertices, number of simplices, and number of simplices of given type, with the coefficients being Burr coupling constants. And so those Burr coupling constants are functions, rather complicated functions of the continuum coupling constants. So the gravitational constant and the cosmological constant, and also the asymmetry factor between the length of timeline links and spatial-like links. I will talk about this also later. So what does this mean? So dynamical triangulations means that we sum over triangulations. But what does this name, this word causal mean? So it means that we assume global proper time foliation of the manifolds that we consider. So each leaf of the foliation is now enumerated with an integer time coordinate. And each leaf is built of equilateral tetrahedra, so it also forms a simplicial manifold and has a fixed topology. So the spatial topology is fixed and we can control it in CDT, and this is important. And we do not allow this topology to change in time. And so far we considered mainly spherical and toroidal spatial topology. In this talk, I will focus only on toroidal spatial topology. So you take a slice, and so the leaves of the foliation, we call them spatial slices or slices. Each slice is a T3, three-dimensional torus. So the total topology is S1, because we assume periodic boundary conditions in time, times T3, so T4, basically. And because of this foliation, we have a distinction between time-like and spatial-like links. So the weak rotation is well-defined by performing an analytical continuation of the length of time-like links. And this time-periodic boundary conditions are chosen basically for simplicity, so that we don't have to deal with boundary terms. And as you can see on this picture below, the topology of slices is fixed, so we do not allow for such branches like you can see here. Okay, so this is our setup, and now because of this foliation and this distinction between time-like and spatial-like links, we deal with two types of simplices. So we call them 4-1 and 3-2. So a 4-simplex is a generalization of a triangle to 4 dimensions. Like a triangle has 3 vertices, a 4-simplex has 5 vertices. And this number 4-1 means that 4-1 means that we have 4 vertices in slice T and 1 vertex in the next slice. So a simplex always connects a given slice with the previous or next slice. So there are no simplices that connect slice T and T plus 2, only T and T plus 1. And the second type of simplices, 3-2, means that there are 3 vertices in slice T and 2 vertices in the next or previous slice. Okay, so what we do, we take a bunch of those simplices and glue them together so that the topology is proper and that it has a proper foliation. And now, if you take more and more of those simplices and make them smaller, you can approximate basically every smooth manifold better and better, like you can see on this picture of a bunny. And now, even though our simplices are four-dimensional, so we treat them as fundamental building blocks, what we can build from them doesn't have to be necessarily four-dimensional. And if we do glue them in a random way, most likely what we get wouldn't be any nice four-dimensional object, not something that you would call to be a four-dimensional object. So like if you take Lego blocks, Lego blocks, even though they are three-dimensional objects, you can just glue one on top on another and get something that is one-dimensional, or you can build something that behaves like a plane, so it's two-dimensional, or you can build something three-dimensional. Or if you glue it in, glue together in more or less a random way, you can get something that is fractal. So, and this is something that we observe in CDT. So even though our building blocks are four-dimensional objects, what you get isn't necessarily a nice, smooth, four-dimensional universe, because what we glue together, what we build is basically a universe. So here's another example that if you take a large enough number of these building blocks and they're small, then you can approximate whatever manifold or geometry you want. Okay, so what we do is we take some initial triangulation so that it has a proper topology and foliation. And then we use Monte Carlo techniques to generate next triangulations. So we always perform local moves and we accept or reject them with certain probability. And if we do it in a proper way, we are ensured that we generate our triangulations according to this measure. So this is how Monte Carlo simulations work. We have to ensure ergodicity. So this basically means that by a series of those small local changes, we can get from any configuration to any other. The moves, they do preserve the topology and they do preserve the foliation. So causality is ensured. And in four-dimensional CDT, we have seven types of partner moves. And also, we have an additional volume fixing term, which means that we are fluctuating around some target volume. So here's an example of a Monte Carlo move in two dimensions. It's just we flip this edge, like you can see it here, and get after this one move, we get a slightly different triangulation. And if you make, let's say, 1 billion of those moves, you get a completely independent triangulation. So what is important that if you fulfill these conditions and the detailed balance condition, which takes into account the action, then you probe a set of you probe the space of configurations according to the measure E2 minus Regia action. And then if you have this hopefully large set of independent triangulations, you are able to calculate approximations of your expectation values just by calculating a normal mean, because they are already produced or generated according to the proper weight. Okay, and now let me jump to the second part of my talk, which is how to define a good coordinate system and how we did it using classical scalar fields. So far, my simulations are pure gravity. There is no matter involved. And this is what I mean by classical here. Now I will introduce a non-dynamical scalar field. So non-dynamical means that it does not impact the probabilities with which I generate my triangulations. I just find a classical solution for the massless scalar field action after I have generated my triangulation. So I take basically one triangulation and I know that it has a toroidal topology. So it is a T4 manifold. And on this triangulation, I can define four non-contractible and non-equivalent hypersurfaces. And those hypersurfaces are three-dimensional and they are built of equilateral tetrahedra. So I will call them boundaries. And now basically I have in each direction, I have an orthogonal boundary. And so for each boundary, I can introduce a scalar field that has a jump at this boundary. So for example, here we have a two-dimensional picture, a torus, and at every point, you can imagine there sits a scalar field or a real value or two values, because this is a two-dimensional example. And the scalar field basically changes from zero around here up to one to the other side. So you have a jump in this case of amplitude one. So in four dimensions, if we talk about our discrete case, the scalar field sits or is located inside in the center of every simplex. So we assign four real numbers, which we call phi x, phi z, y, phi z, and phi t to each simplex. And those scalar fields will have a jump at the proper boundary. And we will use those values as coordinates. And now, this introduction of or keeping track of these boundaries is a little bit tricky, but they are non-physical. So we only use them to stretch our scalar field so that it changes from basically from 0 to 1. But the exact location or exact realization of the boundary is not important because it is non-physical. So it should not impact our results, or at least the classical solution should depend trivially on the boundary. Okay, and as I said, in fact, we do have a manifold that has a toroidal topology, but the geometry is nothing like a regular torus. It is very fractal, but of course, still the topology is imposed and preserved during our simulations. And we'll see that indeed we observe such pictures maybe in a more direct way. Okay, so now we have a manifold, a simplicial manifold, so a triangulation of a four-dimensional torus. And let's freeze our triangulation and let's consider a real free real massless scalar field. So this is the continuum action. And since we are dealing with discrete objects, simplicial manifolds, the discrete counterpart of this action has this very simple form. This is just a sum of squares of the differences between field values of adjacent simplices. So here the sum is over or a pair of neighbors where I and j denote simplices. And now our aim is to find the classical solution. So a field that minimizes its action. And as you can see, the solution to this is just a constant field. Then the minimum is 0, and you cannot go below. But this wouldn't be interesting if you just have a constant field in every simplex. So we add this boundary. So now we have for each field, but our problem factorizes into each direction. So let's consider that we have one field, phi, and we have periodic boundary conditions with a jump at one of the boundaries. For example, we can take a field phi x, and we have a jump at the boundary orthogonal to the x direction. And we can introduce it by adding this antisymmetric matrix Bij, which has only values plus or minus one if the link ij crosses the boundary in a positive or negative direction. So it is the boundary is oriented, or zero otherwise if the two simplices don't touch each other. So basically, it means that when we go from one simplex to its neighbor, and we cross a boundary, the simplex observes the value of the scalar field of its neighbor behind the boundary as increased or decreased by one, depending on the orientation. And again, the scalar field is non-dynamical, so it has no impact on the geometry. We freeze, let's say, the geometry, so that amplitude of the jump is not important because the solution will scale exactly with the amplitude of the jump. Okay, so that's why we call it the classical scalar field, because it minimizes this action.
Sorry, Andrei, there is a question by Laurent.
Yes.
I don't understand this last remark. If I have, meaning the continuum theory, if I have a scalar field which has a domain wall, the domain wall would have a energy momentum tensor and would curve the geometry, and so it would have an impact on the geometry.
So,
So it's like adding a particle to a geometry, it creates a black hole.
sorry. Yes,
So
but
having a
here,
jump, you agree, having a jump is a domain wall that creates energy momentum tensor coupling.
that's true, but you can consider here that this is just a technical step. We have some geometry, and we introduce a scalar field that so from the numerical point of view, it worked like that. We generate our triangulations using pure gravity Monte Carlo engine, and then we put on top on for each geometry, we perform a measurement. And this measurement will be like incorporating this scalar field, but it had no impact on the way we generated the geometry. So it's just a technical, it's just a measurement.
So sorry, you don't use this action S phi?
We don't use it. No, not yet. This will be the third part of my talk, where the field will be dynamical. But now it's a non-dynamical dynamical field, only for the purpose of measurement, and because we want to find a coordinate system, because our setup CDT does not require any coordinate system. It does not involve any coordinate systems because it uses only geometric invariants like lengths and angles. So we don't need it, but it would be sometimes it'd be nice to have some good behaving coordinate system, maybe to observe phase transitions or to talk about observables that are easier to express using a coordinate system. But so far, this is a non-dynamical dynamical scalar field. So we want to find a classical solution which minimizes this action, and this just boils down to solving a discrete Poisson equation, where L is our Laplacian. So it is a sparse matrix, which has on the diagonal it has the degree of each simplex, which is the number of neighbors, which is always 5 in this case, and it has minus ones if there is, if Lij is equal minus 1 if simplices I and j are neighbors. And the B vector is just a jump vector obtained from the antisymmetric jump matrix. So technically, it's maybe not so easy to solve it because we have a large number of simplices of order 1 million. So L will be a matrix 1 million times 1 million, but it's we are able to do it. And now the advantage of this setup is that when we modify the boundary, the solution also changes, but in a trivial way. Now, so here is a one-dimensional example. Let's say I introduce a jump between the last and the first bead or dot. And then in this case, I will stretch my solution in the range 0 to 1 if the jump is of order 1. And this is our aim. So the purpose of this boundaries and the jump at the boundary is to stretch our solution. And here is a two-dimensional example. Basically, if we have a value close to 0 on the red side of the boundary, then on the left, the blue side of the boundary, it will be close to 1. So that if you take into account the jump, you have two values that are near to each other. And this basically means that the solution changes from 0 to 1 in a continuous, in a smooth, smooth way. And the other way to view it is to treat that the target space of our scalar field is not a set of real numbers, but that it is the target space of the scalar field is also a circle, S1, and we demanded the winding number to be 1. And then the circumference of this of the circle will be the amplitude of the jump. Okay, so we just have to solve this equation. It is maybe a little bit technically difficult, but I will not go into the details. Okay, so we have just found for given triangulation and given boundary our solution. But in general, the solution in higher dimensions is not contained in this range 0 to 1. You can imagine that you have, if the boundary looks like that, there is a bubble that goes inside, deep inside one side of this region, then you can imagine that you have solutions, you have field values that are larger than one, even though the jump amplitude is one. And then, but as I said, our solution, it transforms trivially under the redefinition of the boundary. And it is always possible to redefine our boundary so that the solution is in the range 0 to 1. And you can see it, how to do it. If you flip, for example, this triangle on the other side of the boundary, so you modify the boundary, it's just equivalent to changing the field value by one. So the solution transforms in a trivial way. And in that way, you can always push down the maximum to be one. So basically, if you have a triangulation and the boundary given direction, then you can just consider an equivalence class of solutions with respect to an operation shift modulo one. Because as you can see from here, if you add a constant value to each field, your action will not change. So it is invariant under shifts, and you can always shift and make modulo one. And in that way, it's just equivalent to redefining our boundary. It's always possible to find such boundary that the solution will be in the range 0 to 1, and still the scalar field will interpolate from 0 on one side of the boundary to 1 on the other side of the boundary. Okay, so we achieved our goal. We have found a solution such that the mapping of the solutions is trivial when you modify the boundary. And we want that because the boundary itself is a non-physical object. Okay, and we can now consider one phase that appears in CDT, the so-called de Sitter phase. For toroidal spatial topology, a typical configuration looks like a nice cylinder. We have periodic boundary conditions in time. And as I said, we have our foliation, which is enumerated with integer time coordinate. And for each slice, you can calculate its volume, which is the number of equilateral tetrahedra. And for torus, this volume profile is more or less constant. It's not the case for a sphere. And now, so on one hand, we have a typical, we just take a typical quantum geometry or triangulation that appears in our path integral for this phase. And now we add this non-dynamical scalar field, or in fact, four scalar fields with jumps in four directions. And now we have four numbers for each simplex, and we can plot it. We can just make a scatter plot. Of course, it's difficult to plot it, to plot this four-dimensional object, but we can project it on some planes, and then we have a two-dimensional picture. So in this case, we have the scalar field with a jump in the time direction on the x-axis, so phi t is here, and a scalar field with a jump in the x-axis, phi x here. And we project phi y and phi z on this plane. Now, basically, one simplex is one pixel, one color pixel here. And we observe a nice picture of voids and filaments here that's also observed in cosmology, but so far it's only a qualitative comparison. But it still says that indeed we observe a propagating in time disturbance of our geometry. Because basically on the horizontal axis, we have a time coordinate. And I should also say something about the color. So the color of each pixel is basically, the color depends on the original time coordinate of our foliation. So we project here phi y and phi z, but the color is not exactly the time coordinate on this plot. It is the time coordinate of our foliation, yet the correlation is very, very strict. So our new coordinate, phi t, it is very correlated with the original time coordinate of the foliation. It doesn't have to be like that. And it's not exact. It can be skewed or it can be smeared, but more or less it behaves in the same way.
Andrei, sorry, there is a question by Hank.
Yes.
Yeah, hello. I have a question regarding the classical fields. Like presumably in CDT, you're in, after all the computations, you're taking the thermodynamic limit where all the lengths of the symplices go to zero.
Yes, we would like to do it.
Mm-hmm. But then in the classical limit where you, you know, discretize the scalar field action, you get these terms that are proportional to like phi I squared.
Yes.
Yeah. So I was thinking like, wouldn't that like diverge in the thermodynamic limit?
So I think the problem is like on a regular lattice where you also have to deal with this divergent kinetic term basically, which dominates.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So probably you will have to treat it in the same same way. You can this will be more important for dynamical scalar fields, but basically you can just add a coupling constant that multiplies the action for the scalar field, and then you have to tune this coupling constant properly so that I think that you will have to deal with those divergences in the same way as you deal for regular lattices.
Mm-hmm. Because I've seen like the action you've written down looks very similar to like a tight binding kind of yeah. Model. And they have to do all sorts of regularization and stuff like that. But yeah.
Yes, probably you will have to do the same here. But this is not mm-hmm. important for this non-dynamical scalar fields because
right.
We just want to minimize our action. And basically this means that we want to minimize the kinetic, the action is only the kinetic term in this case. We have no mass term. We want to minimize it. Okay. So,
can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Yes, I'm a bit puzzled. I'm puzzled by the role of these scalar fields because you're saying they're not dynamical. They don't affect the geometry.
Yes.
And the boundary conditions are non-physical. So what happens if you introduce matter? I mean, in a normal quantum field theory, if you introduce scalar fields, they couple to the matter somehow, dynamically.
Yes, I will talk about this in the next part of my talk. What happens if we introduce matter that is minimally coupled to gravity? And then the matter action will impact the action that we use to generate our triangulations. But let me first finish with this part, and then I will go to dynamical scalar fields. Maybe the plot on the right-hand side. So the top plot is this volume profile. So basically number of tetrahedra for each slice. Here we have only 20 slices. And this n of phi t is basically, if you take a bin, if you bin the horizontal axis, how many simplices are given bin? So here the distribution is more or less uniform, as you would expect for a uniform cylinder. Okay, and now it's this basic. This plot is in the phi t and phi x coordinates, and now I will show the same triangulation but projected on different coordinate, on different plane, so phi x and phi y. So the horizontal axis is now phi x and the vertical axis is phi y. So it's like rotating the previous four-dimensional picture. and looking from behind. So now time is orthogonal to our screen. And the color of the pixel depends on the original time coordinate, our foliation. So we have this nice picture of voids and filaments. And we'll see that if we go to other phases, the picture will be completely different. Now you can see more plots at this address, but I will have a lot of plots during my presentation, so this is maybe not that important now. Now, let us explain the properties of those pictures that we have that I have shown. So for our T4 configuration, we assign four real numbers to each simplex. So we have a set of four coordinates. Basically, what I plot is volume density distribution, which is kind of self-contradictory because each pixel here, each color pixel denotes more or less one simplex. Of course, they can overlap, but let's say that one pixel, one color pixel is one simplex. And if you have a dense cloud of pixels or of simplices, you in fact have a large volume because volume is connected to a simplex. Each simplex within the same type, we have two types of simplices, holds the same amount of volume. So it doesn't mean that you have a dense matter or whatever. It rather means that you have an outgrow with large volume. Okay, I'll talk about this also in the next slides. And the exact position of given simplex is here irrelevant because everything is up to shift modulo one, given up to shift modulo one, because you can always shift it and take the boundary in a different way, and then the picture will change. But up to that, if we change the boundary, it will only change by a shift in given direction. Now, what is important that the coordinates defined that way, they preserve the structure of a triangulation. And this is because the solution to the Poisson equation has this property that basically the value of the solution for given simplex is equal to the mean of its neighbors, or the coordinates of its neighbors. So if a simplex is between its neighbors, then this pixel will also be between its neighbors. And this I call it, it preserves the structure of a triangulation. And now the phi t coordinate is not the same as the coordinate that enumerates our leaves of the foliation, but it is quite correlated. Okay, and as I said before, we have a lot of proofs that show that our triangulations are nothing like a smooth geometry. It is very fractal, although it still have the imposed topology of a torus. And this pattern of voids and filaments, it denotes basically that we have an outgrow in our slice that propagates to slices in the next times, next slices. And this is a quite non-trivial result that the fluctuation of the geometry that it propagates in time in our for our configurations. So the solutions have this property that basically an outgrow in our geometry will be visible as dense cloud of points. Because if we take this geometry, so it is a torus with some outgrowths, and now we cut it along the boundaries, so the red boundary and the blue boundary, and we end up with a picture like that. And now we flatten it. We flatten the outgrowths. We end up with something like this. So the boundaries are still visible here. It doesn't really matter where they are, we can redefine them, we can move them so that to another boundary which is equivalent. But you can see that what was previously an outgrow is now a dense dense region of triangles in this case, and the solution to the Poisson equation or to Laplace equation has the same property, that the scalar field changes slowly inside an outgrow. And this means if the scalar field changes slowly inside an outgrow, it means that on the picture that I have shown, symplices inside the same outgrow will be visible as points that are close to each other. So now we can give some interpretation to this plot. If we have some region that is dense, it basically denotes an outgrow. And if I plot it so that on the horizontal axis I have a scalar field net with a jump in the time direction, and I observe a fiber that spans that has some length or extension in the time direction, denotes that I have an outgrow that propagates to the next slice. And this is a property that we would like to have. Okay. And now let me say a few words about the phase structure. We have three coupling constants, K0, K4, and delta, but K4 plays a role of a Lagrange multiplier. So it's connected to the cosmological constant, but it basically tunes the total volume. So we end up with only two coupling constants that we can freely choose. And the phase structure is quite rich in CDT. We have four phases, and they have different property. The geometry looks different, that they have different number of vertices and or symplices of type 3-2. But if we take a typical configuration for a given phase and plot the picture like I did using the scalar fields, we'll get each time a very different picture. So this is one of the phases, so called oscillatory phase, where basically if you look at the volume profile, so the number of tetrahedra in each slice, it jumps from some minima to maxima. So it seems like the slices are not correlated. So here is just some visualization of this triangulation of this phase of typical triangulations in this phase, and this is how our cloud of points looks, clouds of symplices looks in the scalar field coordinates. So phi t here, phi x here, and now phi x phi y phase A. Now we have a bifurcation phase which has this property that we have vertices with a large coordination number. So we have vertices that are shared by a large number of symplices. So even though this the triangulations there look quite similar to the C phase, in those coordinates, it looks completely different. It's much more localized around some value. This is phi x, phi y. The B phase, the so-called collapsed phase, has this property that we have only one slice, and basically all volume, all symplices are localized in this slice. So it's collapsed to one time slice, and this it's also visible here. Okay, so this was about the phase structure here. You can clearly see that using those coordinates, we can discriminate, distinguish between different phases. And this is a nice property. And now let me start the last part of my talk, which is about dynamical scalar fields. And here I will consider basically two cases. We have, due to foliation, we have a distinction between the time direction and spatial directions. So we need those boundaries to introduce a jump, and we can introduce a jump in the time direction or jumps in the spatial direction. So in the first part of this section, I will talk about a jump in time direction. So previously, the scalar field was non-dynamical. It was only introduced to get some notion of coordinates on an existing triangulation. But now we will consider the action for a massless scalar field. So we can ask a question, what is the effect of dynamical scalar fields on our underlying quantum geometric degrees of freedom? We basically use the same action, but now we'll assume that the target space of the scalar field is also S1 with circumference delta, and we demand that the winding number will be also one. So each time, maybe if I go back to this plot here, each time I go around in some direction, I also demand that the value of the scalar field also goes once around in the target space. Okay, and now we have one more coupling constant, namely this amplitude of this jump, delta, and we can check what happens when we vary its value. And so if we expand our scalar field around the classical solution, this discrete action, it factorizes very nicely into the quantum part, which is written with the red color here, and the classical part. And now we have observed, basically for a given triangulation T, the classical action means that I just calculate the action for a classical solution, which I discussed before, and it behaves like the amplitude of a jump squared. Now, we can also consider a scalar field, a dynamical scalar field without a jump, but in this case, we have only this red part, and it is just a Gaussian function, so we can integrate out the scalar field, and it will behave like a log. The effective action will be logarithm of the determinant of the Lagrangian, but we have to, if we get rid of the zero mode, but we have checked that this only the quantum scalar field with the winding number zero, so this is this eta here, does not have any important impact on the geometries. So we can see that if we now change delta to a non-zero value, so now it's the winding number necessarily has to be equal one, at some point, this S classical will dominate the action for pure gravity. And one can expect that the impact of the dynamical scalar field will be important, but the main contribution will come from the classical solution, from the classical part around which we expanded, rather than from quantum fluctuations. And this is exactly what happens. So now we have only one scalar field with a jump in the time direction. So I cannot plot this clouds as before because I don't have coordinates phi x, phi y, phi z. I have only phi t, which I don't plot here. But on this plot, you see the volume profile, so as a function of our foliation time. So basically, I calculate the number of tetrahedra in each slice, and you can see that at some point, when the amplitude of the jump is large enough, my solution changes basically from a constant solution to a cosine solution. So we have the Einstein-Hilbert action is invariant under time translations. And the same is true for Redshift action. So if you want to treat our triangulations in a meaningful way, because we have a spontaneous symmetry breaking, we have to, when calculating averages, we have to center the triangulation. So if you do this centering procedure before you take an average over configurations, you necessarily will create always this biased jump here. So for this blue and purple curves, even though it is not exactly constant, it's probably because of a technical reasons. And this means that when you cross some threshold value of the jump, your solution will jump from a constant solution, uniform volume profile, to a cosine solution. So for the blue line is the result of our measurements in full CDP with a jump of equal to 8. And the red curve is a fit of a cos to power 1 function. And this this is important because we can explain it using a mini superspace model. So let me say what is a mini superspace model. It is a model where we assume spatial homogeneity and isotropy. So basically, our only degree of freedom is the scale factor or the volume of a slice. And in full CDT, even though we can measure the slice volume, we don't freeze any degree of freedom. We integrate out all degrees of freedom except the scale factor. In the mini superspace model, we freeze all degrees of freedom except the scale factor. So it will give like a dominating contribution, but it is not the full quantum model. CDT is. So if you make this assumption and insert it into the Einstein-Hilbert action with the matter part, you will end up with something like this. So there, we want to find a solution that minimizes this action under certain constraints. And one constraint is the total volume has to be fixed, because this is what we do in our simulations. And the jump of the scalar field is also fixed. Also, for technical reasons, we cannot go with the size of slice below certain value, because the topology of a slice is a T3, and it is not allowed to shrink to zero. So we also have some threshold, some minimal value of a simplex. And this threshold will be also important. And basically, you have two types of solutions for this that minimize this action. You have a constant solution, and it does minimize this action when delta is smaller than 2 pi. And you have a cosine solution that does minimize this action when you have the jump above this threshold. So here is a plot of the solution. You have a stalk with some minimal volume epsilon, and then you have a cosine function, and then you can stalk. And now the red line here is a constant solution that is preferred when the jump is smaller. So this is basically this v dot squared divided by v is basically the gravity part, which it tries to make the change of the volume as small as possible. On the other hand, the matter part prefers smaller volumes. And in this region where the volume is small, the field has to change from zero to delta. And it can change more rapidly in the small volume area, and then it will change slower here, and then again change rapidly here. So the field would like to have a region that with small volume. So at some point when the jump is large enough, the contribution from the scalar field will prevail over the geometric part of the action, and we'll have a transition from a constant solution to a cosine solution. Thus, we have a pinching in this, this area caused by the scalar field. And this is something that we observed in our full CDT model. Okay, and so, here is maybe another plot where I calculated the action. This action this action under those constraints as a function of delta. And below 2 pi, the action for the constant solution is smaller than the action from the cosine solution. And it exactly agrees here by simulations. I mean, where I simulate this simplified model, it exactly agrees with the analytical calculations. So indeed, we have a first order transition where the solution jumps from a constant solution to a cosine solution, to a blob-like solution. And it is indeed a jump. It's not like the cosine solution starts and changes smoothly from a cosine solution. At this point, delta equal to pi, let's say these two solutions have the same action. So there will be a jump from a constant to a blob that is far away from a constant solution. So this was for a jump in time direction. So we had only one scalar field with a jump in time direction. Now I will consider three dynamical scalar fields with jump in spatial directions. So we have fields phi x, phi y, and phi z. And the jump in each direction is the same, equal to delta. And now I will plot the same picture as before, projected on a plane phi t phi x. So again, one pixel is one simplex. And,
there is a question by Hank.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry for asking so many questions, but in the previous slide, so I can interpret the cosine solution as an instant top, right? So it's a topological transition.
I don't understand the question. Could you repeat it?
Like the cosine solution is an instant top, is it?
Yes.
Oh, so okay.
It's a very similar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's a topological transition, basically, when you tune delta to be above a single one.
Yes, yes. And I will discuss it later.
Okay. Thank you.
So you're welcome. So now we have jumps in spatial directions, and I increase the jump amplitude. And we can observe that some structures are forming. And now clearly you can see a jump between 3 and 4. And now let me focus on this this part because explanation for what happens here consists of two stages. And the first stage is basically here happens the same as happened just for the jump in the time direction. So the difference between spatial directions and time directions that we have no foliation in spatial directions, but still we have some extensions, and we still will observe a pinching in the sense that if we introduce a scalar field with a large enough jump in one direction, this scalar field will dynamically create a region with small volume because it needs this region to change. We can observe here we have phi t on the x-axis and phi x on the y-axis, on the vertical axis. And we observed exactly what I discussed before in the phi x direction. There is now, you basically, phi x and phi y and phi z is also plotted on this plot here. So you can treat this plot here as a volume on a slice orthogonal to given direction to direction phi x, phi y, and phi z, and you can observe a condensation. The volume is localized. And this is exactly this pinching, this cosine solution in only the phi x direction. But let's see what happens if we keep increasing the jump amplitude. So here it looks the same, but now we observe that there is a localization not only in the direction where we have a jump, but also in the time direction. So on the horizontal axis, we have phi t, so basically the time coordinate. We have a condensation in the time direction, even though there was no jump or even no scalar field of the jump in this direction. Okay, and it's getting even more localized. And now I will show this basically the same plot, but projected on planes phi x and phi y. So I will remind you that we have a jump in directions phi x, phi y, phi z. So the scalar field will prefer to construct, localize my symplices in this direction. So we expect to observe a range that this will be dense both in phi x and phi y. And you can observe those condensations. And here was this jump observed previously. And now we are, this is the same triangulation as before, but rotated in 90 degrees, so that now the time phi t coordinate is orthogonal to the screen. And you can observe the localization both in phi x and phi y directions, and also phi z, but this is not visible here. And when we increase our jump, it's getting only smaller. So basically all symplices are now localized in the center of the screen. Okay, so what for this large jump, what is the volume profile then? And it's not a cosine to the power one anymore, it's cosine to power three. It's a cubic function of the cosine function. So can we explain it? And the answer is yes. And again, we can use the mean superspace model, but now using the model for a spherical spatial topology. Okay, so what really happens here is a change of the topology. As I said, introducing a scalar field produces a pinching. So the scalar field prefers a region with basically zero volume. So from a constant, from a uniform cylinder, I get a blob where I basically pinch the cylinder at some point. Like visible on this plot, I have a torus and now I contract here the endpoint, but it is periodic also. I have to glue together the, identify the left part and the right part. And effectively, I end up with a topology change where from a torus, I get something simply connected. And S3, which is a small part that contains the genus, the whole. And of course, the exact topology is preserved during our simulations. But what we observe is that from a central part with this genus and some number of outgrowths, we end up with a very small toroidal part and one huge outgrowth. So here this toroidal part is exaggerated so that we can see it, but just this part, which previously was relatively large, now is very small. So the vast majority of symplices form a sphere, a four-dimensional sphere, or three-dimensional sphere at the beginning, with the torus in the small part on. So this pinching results in an effective change of spatial topology. Although the exact topology is, of course, still the same, but effectively it is we have a topology change. Okay, and so what happened? Now introducing a jump in spatial direction, it resulted in a pinching in spatial directions. And now instead of spatial slices that are toruses, that are tori, now we have effectively a change of the topology of spatial slices into a sphere. And this was something that we studied earlier. This was the original approach in CDT when the spatial topology was indeed a sphere. And in this case, if you consider the mean superspace model, you have an additional term coming from the curvature v volume of a slice to power 1/3, which is absent in the toroidal case. So this this red part here is not present in the minisuper space moment, but observed numerically. So it's not, those are quantum corrections, and I will not discuss those. But we have this for a sphere, we have this potential term. And if you find a solution that minimizes this action, it is a cosine cubic function. So when the spatial topology is a sphere, then our volume profiles in a C phase are blob-like, and the average volume profile is cosine cubic function. Okay, so I think that using this mini superspace model, we managed to explain what happens when you add dynamical scalar fields with a non-trivial target space and demand that the winding number of the target space will be one and the jump large enough. So basically, what happens if the topology of the target space agrees with the topology of our manifolds that we study here? Okay, so we also managed to explain why we have a cosine this function here and here, but this is maybe not that important for this talk. I have to finish now, but it is predicted by the mini superspace model, and this is good that our so CDP is a full non-perturbative quantum model in this way that we don't freeze any degrees of freedom. The all geometries, piecewise linear geometries, are possible as long as they have the proper topology which we can control and impose foliation. And the geometry is basically encoded in the connectivity of simplices. And now the first test that every quantum model should, quantum theory should obey is its agreement with the classical theory in the classical limit. And you can treat the mini superspace model, the classical solutions for the mini superspace model, you can treat as what you should get in the classical limit. So we get this agreement on different levels, and this is a good test. Okay, so let me shortly summarize what I was talking about. So CDT is a model of quantum fluctuations of the geometry at the Planck scale. And we introduce coordinates to basically measure our geometries using real classical scalar fields. We had to introduce some boundaries in order to do that, but the boundaries itself are non-physical. And we can use these coordinates to study phase transitions. And this is always nice to have, we always desire some observables to do that. And we can also now visualize using those coordinates, visualize our triangulations, it's not possible to just embed them in our form. Okay, and the pictures are also nice. And now, if we introduce dynamical scalar field, then we observe that if the jump is large enough, they have a dramatic effect on the underlying quantum geometries that contribute to the CCD path integral. And we have observed a new kind of coupling between the topology of matter fields and the topology of space-time, which resulted most likely in a phase transition as a function of this amplitude jump. And the mini superspace model for a jump in the time direction predicts a first order phase transition as a function of this delta parameter. And this is also something that we observe in our simulations. And what is also nice that if we consider this global parameters like slice volume, we get a very good agreement with classical models. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrei, for this very interesting talk. Okay, so are there questions first from students? Ding?
Hi, thanks for the nice talk. I have a clarification question.
Yes.
For the plot you showed with the colored pixels, does that refer to a single configuration or an ensemble?
Yes, configuration? It is a single configuration in each case.
Now, if I look at the whole ensemble of configurations, I guess you because the phi x, phi y, etc. values, they can be matched among different configurations. Because you can put the different different plots.
Well,
different
for example. Finish your question, maybe. First.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, if you put different configurations on top of each other, will the filaments match with each other?
No. So in the C phase, where basically the volume profile is more or less uniform and it behaves uniformly in each direction, if you would try to average it over configurations, you will get something that is uniform, and you will observe, I don't know, just a gray area everywhere. Now, this is the same problem as how to, basically, we don't know how to make an average of a geometry. Now, you need to average numbers. You can only calculate an average. You can average over configurations, but you need to average as numbers. This is the only thing you can average. You cannot average geometries. And now, it's the same problem as for the volume profile. If you take a typical configuration and measure the volume profile for it, for example, in this case, it will be like something like a Gaussian function, or you will get a blob. So there is a spontaneous symmetry breaking, because the Einstein-Hilbert action and the Regge action, it is invariant under the time translation. So basically, you can redefine, you can shift your time coordinate, and you will get an equally good triangulation. So if you just perform an average in a naive way, you will regain the uniform solution. So you have to when performing an average, you have to take this into account and basically break the symmetry by hand. So center the configuration and then perform the average. And this is what I have done here. And only in this case, after the centering procedure, you can calculate the average and you will get this cosine cubic function. And so probably the same you will have to do here. As I said, there is a shift modulo 1 symmetry here. You can, if you change the boundary, you will shift your picture, basically, modulo 1. And the reason that this line is in the center is only for visual effects. It's I have chosen my boundary in such a way that the line is in the center. It doesn't have to be. And now if you don't do the centering and you just perform a naive average over configuration, you will get something that is uniform. So I would expect that the picture after an average of a configuration is tricky to do it properly. And definitely, if you take two different configurations, they should be independent, and we would like them to be independent. And then this pattern of voids and filaments will be completely different, and it will average out to something uniform.
I see. Then suppose I want to connect this filament in your results with the filaments in the universe. You observe, I guess.
So to make a more quantitative comparison.
I have to decide whether I want to average out the among the ensemble.
Well, but you can measure, then you should average out not the pictures, but for example, calculate correlations. Correlation between phi, between fields as a function of distance or difference between the vectors, and then you have numbers and you can talk about averaging. And this is something that we plan to do.
I see.
So thanks. Basically calculate the propagator or correlator.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next there is a question by Hank.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for the very interesting talk. The topological phase transition I'm actually very interested in. So in the phase diagram that you had before, can I see which phase boundary is it crossing for the phase?
No, it's none of them. So this the phase diagram here is, do you refer to this picture?
Yeah.
This is a pure gravity case.
Oh, no scalar fields, okay.
No scalar field at all. And now we have, you can say we have one more coupling constant, this delta, so it will be orthogonal to this plane.
Right, so which phase did you start in? I guess it's the...
It's the De Sitter phase, but the name De Sitter is not proper for torus. It makes sense for a spherical spatial topology. Mm-hmm. Where indeed we have a De Sitter solution. For torus, we have a uniform solution, but then the name, for historical reasons, was kept. Mm-hmm. So I was only talking about, except here where I was talking about given phase, in all other plots, I was referring to the C phase.
Okay. The plots that you showed in the A phase is actually quite interesting because it looks like you have a whole bunch of like colloids or these cigars.
Yes. Well, I don't know if what you exactly see, because maybe Zoom is smoothing it out and anti-aliasing and so on. But I'm not sure exactly what's on your side. But I think it agrees with our intuition that we have it's this oscillatory phase where we have basically small independent universes. And it's like here, you have a universe here and then another universe here that is decoupled, they are decoupled. So this would agree with our old interpretation, like on this artistic view here.
Right, like because I'm just... sort of using my intuition to see that there's a sort of ordering in the horizontal direction.
So the horizontal axis is the time phi t.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Vertical direction, yeah, sorry.
And now if you look from top, for example, so that you have phi x here and phi y here, you lose the structure because now the probably this structure here you can see the cigars or this regions are due to our imposed foliation, because in other directions where we don't have this foliation it looks like this, so we don't have this this structure.
Okay.
So here we have the description on which directions I'm projecting.
Can I ask?
Okay, I see. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead, John.
Yeah. I just want to understand the role of the classical scalar fields and quantum gravity. So if you do cosmology, you have to have matter present. So you do have to have these classical scalar fields involved. So in cosmology, the gravitational field is weak, as we know. Mm-hmm. So you're dealing with low energy infrared gravity. So if you do perturbation theory, if you interpret it in terms of field theory, you have tree graphs, which are the classical solution, and you have loop graphs. And the loop graph contribution is, of course, very small because the gravity theory field is weak. You're nowhere near the Planck scale.
Yes.
So in this case, it seems to me that these filaments and voids are due to the dynamical scalar fields and their potential quantum corrections. I don't see how quantum gravity enters into it from a measurement point of view.
So for this plot here, so we basically use this classical scalar fields only to get this picture, to perform the measurement on our triangulations. And now to the full path integral, basically all possible triangulations contribute, but the action, the radial action that we use, it prefers some triangulations or some geometries with lower value of the action. So basically our model is a full non-perturbative model where whatever we measure comes as an interplay of both the entropy, so number of triangulations with given properties, and the action. And so the quantum part is basically just this entropy part, but the classical GR action, it decides which region of triangulations to probe. And so in this sense, the quantum picture reveals itself in this presence of fractal outgrowths. So if we just were considered only classical solutions to GR, there would be some smooth geometries. But now, because we are performing non-perturbative calculations, so basically all triangulation, all geometries that fluctuate around the classical solution also contribute to the path integral. And since our approach is non-perturbative, so we don't re-expand around a classical solution, but we just sum over all possible triangulations. So this quantum gravity or quantum gravity adds up here, or reveals itself by this quantum geometries, which are very rough and fractal. And this is visible in this plot here, because our interpretation was that a dense region denotes an outgrowth, a slice, and then a fiber that propagates denotes a propagating and evolving outgrowth in time. So the fibers here, they just reveal the presence of fractal outgrowths, and the fractal outgrowths are definitely a manifestation of a quantum behavior here.
So you're saying that even though the quantum gravity contribution expect in cosmology is expected to be very small, I mean, I can't see it any other way, that it's still
contributes. I just visualize a pure gravity case. So I don't even compare it with any matter. I only use this classical scalar field to perform this measurement on some typical triangulation that appears in my path integral. And a single configuration is not physical, just like a single trajectory that contributes a path integral is not physical. Physical observables is just an expectation, is an expectation value of some observables. So, but we can talk about what geometries are more probable than others, but since we don't have a dynamical scalar field, the matter action does not influence the probability at which we generate our triangulations. We cannot compare the strength of gravity with anything other here. You can do it for this.
Yeah, because you did say you did say on a slide that for the pure gravity case, you're considering a Planck scale physics.
Yes.
So in which case, it's not perturbative. At the Planck scale, you can expect quantum gravity to come in.
It's not perturbative in the sense that we sum
at
over
the Planck scale. Yeah.
We sum over all geometries, yeah. So we don't expand it perturbability. We don't expand it around any geometry put by hand or classical. We just sum over all possible triangulations, geometries, weighted with the Einstein-Hilbert action.
The only thing is that Planck scale physics is very hard to measure, but that's yes. neither here nor there at the moment. So,
yes. So since we are running out of time, I would now go to the next question by Benjamin.
Yes, thank you for this really nice talk. It was very interesting. I have two questions. The first one is related to using these scalar fields as coordinate system. And you mentioned that you can see the difference of the different phases in these pictures. And I was wondering whether you can make this mathematically precise in terms of an order parameter that you can say, okay, this picture is definitely in phase A, this picture is in phase B, this picture is in phase C, or is it purely that you look at the picture and you see the difference?
This is our plan. So far it's just by looking at it, but it would be nice to maybe use also this and some machine learning techniques to automatically decide if given configuration is in phase A, B, or C, and to make this process more automatic. But those are future plans.
Okay, great. The second question is to the last part of your talk about the dynamic scalar field. And I was wondering, have you also looked into scalar fields that have a self-interaction, like a 5^4 interaction? I think this would be really interesting.
Oh, no, we didn't look at that.
Is it planned?
Not in the nearest future.
Just out of curiosity, is there some roadblock to implement that, or is it just
another? Well, we started a massive scalar field, and we just added a phi squared term. Yes, so adding this such potential to CDT is trivial. You just have here plus sum over I phi I squared or phi. Yes. I^4. So it is trivial. We looked at it in the more than 12 years ago. I also had a presentation about dynamical scalar fields in CDT, but we had no publication there in the massive case. Mm-hmm. So probably we will study the massive case and then some other potentials. But I'm afraid there will be nothing interesting. So basically, adding a massive any potential that will limit the amplitude of fluctuation of the scalar field will make the impact of the scalar field even less pronounced. So basically, adding, for example, a quadratic term, a massive quadratic term, makes the scalar field even weaker. And without this jump, the red part, so this is a massless scalar field with winding number zero, so just quantum fluctuations, it already has a very small effect on on what we observe. There is maybe some shift in the phases in the phase diagram. There is some shift in the coupling constants, but we observe the same phases. The volume profiles are very similar. There's basically no change of the volume profile for torus. There is only, if you take it was this plot. You take spherical spatial topology and calculate the average volume profile, you get the red curve. And now if you add one or multiple scalar fields, the only change is that this blob is getting more narrow. And if you add mass, the higher mass, the weaker the effect. And it's very easy to explain why massive scalar fields has a smaller effect than massless scalar. This is because if you add a mass, you basically restrict the amplitude of fluctuations of the scalar field. And if the mass is large enough, you only have the mass term. The kinetic term, you can neglect the kinetic term, maybe here. Here you have only the kinetic term, phi I minus phi j squared. And if you add a mass term plus m squared phi I squared, if m is large enough, then you can neglect the kinetic part, and basically the couple every simplex decouples, and you just have sum over simplices phi I squared. So the only change, you can then easily integrate out your scalar field, and the only change would be a contribution to the cosmological constant, and that's it. So it will be trivial, and you will be always able to counterbalance the impact of the scalar field by changing one of the coupling constant K4 here, Baryer coupling constants here. So a scalar field with a large mass, the impact of a scalar field with a large mass is trivial.
Yeah, I see the argument, but the reason I'm asking is that at least from, I mean, a range of investigations, we know that scalar field theory in four dimensions is trivial. So it would be interesting if you can still find a second order phase transition of a scalar field coupled to gravity to go around this triviality problem that we have also in the standard model. So I think I see your argument, but it might be a little bit more complicated when you go to to non-perturbative values of this coupling. Yes.
But we have more plans than power.
Yes. As we all have, I guess.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Are there other questions? Okay. So if not, let's thank Jaina and Andrei for the nice talk and discussion.
Yeah.